My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
It is essential that our team learns to work with our new recruit, not against him.
I'm a geek, walking down the street.
Check the computer.
The mainframe computer.
I access the mainframe.
At the end of this day, one shall stand, one shall fall.
Time to find out.
Welcome to Basically a Geek Show. Here are your hosts, Mike and Jack.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 21 of Basically a Geek Show, episode of Extinction. I'm Mike. With me, as always, is Jack.
What's up? Wait, we're becoming extinct this episode?
No, we're going to talk about Age of Extinction. No, that's what we're going to do. No, but this episode means that the show is now old enough to drink in the United States.
This show's been drinking since the first episode, sir. Hint, listeners, none of our shows have been recorded while we were both completely sober.
Let's move right into it. I saw Age of Extinction on opening day Friday. And I figured let's discuss Age of Extinction, because I actually have a lot to say about this movie. I had certain expectations going in. I was perhaps a bit optimistic and willing to kind of give the movie some... I was optimistic in giving in my opinions of what the movie could be, but I was still kind of held in check by expectations set by the first three, most notably the last two. I still think the first one holds up rather well. It's really only Revenge of the Fallen, and to a lesser extent, Dark of the Moon, where things kind of got where the wheels kind of came off a bit. But that being said, I came into Age of Extinction a bit optimistic, but also, you know, with my expectations in check. And maybe it's just lower expectations, but damn it, I was impressed. A lot of what the movie surprised me in a lot of ways I didn't think it would. I got way more out of this than I thought I would. And I was prepared to say, you know what, for what it is, it's good. No, I'll say it right now. I thought it's the best one. It's the best movie since the first one. It might even be better than the first one. And damn it, this makes me excited for the movie franchise again. After Dark of the Moon, I was sort of ready for it to be over, and I was just sort of ready to be like, oh, they're going to stretch it out to a fourth one. It's just going to be a mess. But no. I went from being bored of the movie franchise to going, you know what? That last one was pretty damn good, and I can't wait to see what they do with it. So I'm impressed all around. Any of our listeners, I'm assuming that anyone who listens to the show has at least a passing interest in Transformers. So, to our listeners, I would recommend see it. If you haven't already, definitely see it. Again, it's not this ain't Shakespeare. It's not going to be anything that revolutionizes how you view the franchise or how you view fiction in general. But you'll have a hell of a time. Your expectations from the last three will be surpassed, and you'll walk away going, you know what? Damn it, that was fun, and I want to see what else they do. So that's my non-spoiler review of it.
Yeah, now, as for this point on, if you're spoiler sensitive, either put on your big boy britches and continue listening, or just skip ahead until whenever the hell you'll figure it out.
Yeah, just skip ahead until you're not hearing us talk about the movie.
So, now, I didn't get to go see it this weekend, just, you know, work schedules and other things that had to be done this weekend, kind of the time really wasn't there. Mm-hmm. The plan is to catch it weekend after next. When I get paid again, as soon as you get it, it's gone, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's my plan.
So, as someone like yourself who has not yet seen it, you have seen the previous three.
Yeah.
And so I guess the best way – I mean, I've got a lot of what I want to talk about, a lot of what I kind of want to expand upon. But I figured I'd ask you, are there any concerns or questions specifically that you'd like me to address? Like, off
well,
of that?
We'll get to that. I do have one that kind of knowing a little bit in advance from our discussion the other night about the movie, or last night about the movie, I do know that one of my concerns seemed to be founded. The rest seemed to be not really well founded. In fact, my worst fears, for the most part, with the exception of one thing, seem to have not been realized. Now, you saying that it's as good as, or the best movie since the first one, maybe even as good as that. That's pretty tough talk.
Mm-hmm.
What particularly, I mean, not any one specific scene unless it was one, but you know, what really stood out about this movie to make you say that?
Well, in the first movie, We got a limited Transformer on Transformer interaction. We got limited room for Transformer character growth in the first one. And I understand why that was. Despite the fact that these movies have gone on to make a lot of money, fact of the matter was, when the first one came out, Transformers was primarily known as a franchise that peaked in the 80s.
Right.
And so, you know, yeah, it had reinvented itself countless times over since the 80s. You had Beast Wars, you had Robots in the Skies, you had the Unicron trilogy up to that point, and you had various comic iterations. So, Transformers was a fluid franchise at the moment, but for the general public in 2007, Transformers was just one of those 80s franchises. And so, the movie studios were like, well, you know, we don't know if this thing's actually gonna be a success, because the whole 80s fad, redone, thing that kind of Transformers had a big part in kicking off hadn't taken hold yet. So, you know, they had to keep the robot screen time limited to basically the big battles because, hey, it costs a lot of money to render scenes with these CGI creations that these robots are. And when you really don't have a guarantee that the first movie's going to be a hit, you want to keep expenses as reasonable as you possibly can, given what you're doing. So I understood the limited Transformer on Transformer interaction and characterization from the first film, and I actually enjoyed what they did give us. I liked Optimus Prime's "Freedom is the right of all sentient beings" speech in the first movie, and I kind of liked the little bit of Decepticon interaction we got, where, you know, when Megatron's first freed. And he's like, where is the Allspark? And Starscream's like, the humans have it. And he's like, you fail me yet again, Starscream. And you know, it's just a couple lines and a couple scenes here and there, but for the Transformer characterization that we got in the first one, it was limited, but I liked what we got.
So basically what you're saying is that this movie is really the first to not simply rely on the human cast for characterization.
Yeah.
They're actually getting giant robots in our giant robot movie this time.
Yeah, like I was saying, we got it limited but well done in the first movie. You'd think after the first movie things would improve a bit, and we got a bit of it in the second movie. Just a bit, when Megatron was on the Nemesis kind of bitch slapping Starscream around a bit. You know, that whole, like, even in death, I'm still in command, that kind of thing. But it was a limited, and then in the third movie, it almost disappeared entirely, save for a few Optimus Sentinel scenes. And in the third movie, and to a lesser extent in the second movie, the robots essentially became props and set pieces that the humans interacted around. And they didn't feel like they had characters. They introduced Wheeljack into the live-action movie-verse.
That was not Wheeljack.
Yeah, there's some debate about it. I'm just going to call him Wheeljack for the sake of discussion.
Yeah, I get you.
But, you know, they introduced Wheeljack. And, you know, Transformers fans know who Wheeljack is. We know who he's supposed to be.
Evidently, but Michael Bay fucking didn't know.
But the point is that the general movie audience doesn't. So, you know, you introduce this character, he doesn't do anything, and then he's killed off after, like, two lines of dialogue in the big final battle. And you're left wondering, well, who the fuck are these robotic characters? Because the movie just didn't take the time to flesh them out. What I'm getting at with this whole long-winded thing is that in Age of Extinction, not only do we see the best Transformer characterization we've had since the first one, we actually see more of it. There are entire scenes in Age of Extinction dedicated to fleshing these robotic characters out, and it's really well done. Ratchet is a character who's been in the franchise for the first three movies. Never really had much to say. You couldn't even really say he has much of a character in the first three movies. And he's killed off by a joint CIA lockdown being one of the primary villains of this, a Cybertronian bounty hunter who doesn't belong to either faction. Lockdown teams up the CIA. They take out Ratchet early on in this movie. And Ratchet gets so much characterization in, like, the 5 minutes that he's on screen at the beginning of this movie that he did in the previous three movies. And when Ratchet's killed, God damn it, they make you feel for Ratchet dying, even though by all accounts you really shouldn't. They do a great job. They give him enough character so that when he is dead, you're like, wow, I'm kind of sad that he's dead. And then you move on to the new cast of characters. Now, there are three new Autobots introduced in this movie. There's Hound, voiced by John Goodman. There is Crosshairs, voiced by John DiMaggio, who a lot of people might know as Bender from Futurama. And then there is Drift, voiced by Ken Watanabe, probably famous for his role as Dr. Shirazawa in the new Godzilla movie.
Let them fight.
Oh, I want to get to that in a moment, because there was a chance to throw in a let them fight line, and they didn't make it, and I was disappointed, because god damn it, that would have been amazing.
Well, they wouldn't have had time to, honestly.
Well, no, like, there's a scene where Optimus and Grimlock throw down near the end.
Oh, and, I gotcha.
And Drift actually makes a rather, I'm skipping ahead here, but when Grimlock and Optimus throw down, Grimlock transforms into a T-Rex for the first time and goes after Optimus, and Drift is off to the side with Crosshairs, and he's like, I was expecting a giant car. Which was, I thought was a funny line. It would have been a great moment to just throw Ken Watanabe a bone and been like, Drift, just have Drift say, let them fight.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's jumping ahead. So the setup here is that after the events of Dark of the Moon, where Chicago was basically fucked by Sentinel's revenge boner, the CIA has declared all Cybertronians, Autobot and Decepticon alike, to be enemies. And the guy at the CIA who's heading this, his name is Harold Attiger in the movie, but I'm just going to call him Fraser Crane.
Lol.
Because he is played by Kelsey Grammer, who does a great job with the character, by the way. Kelsey Grammer gives what is really kind of a one-note character a lot of gravitas. You're like, wow, yeah, I dig that. CIA agent Fraser Crane is leading this task force to round up Autobots, and he's allying himself with Lockdown, who, as I said, is a Cybertronian bounty hunter who doesn't belong to either Autobot or Decepticon. He belongs to neither allegiance. And he's working for aliens only referred to as the Creators. He implies that there is a alien life force out there responsible for the creation of the Cybertronians. And I've heard people speculate that they're the Quintessons. I've heard people speculate that it's Unicron. Point being that there is a nebulous creator who Lockdown is working for. And Lockdown wants Optimus Prime because the creators want Optimus Prime back. So Lockdown comes to this deal with CIA agent Fraser Crane and says, I'll help you track down the remaining Cybertronians on this planet as long as you let me keep Optimus Prime when I find him. So that's sort of your main villain alliance in the movie. And Ratchet, they show Ratchet's been taken out by this group. Leadfoot, one of the Wreckers from Dark of the Moon, is taken out. And So the Autobots on Earth are it's basically down to Optimus, Drift, Crosshairs, Bumblebee, and Hound. And Optimus is in hiding. They explain via backstory that a CIA lockdown sting almost caught Optimus Prime. He was basically shot through the heart by lockdown, managed to survive, and he limped away and is now disguised as a beat-up old truck in Texas somewhere. Mark Wahlberg finds him. He revives him. And what's really interesting is that they really play with the idea that, you know what, Optimus Prime might have some PTSD.
How so?
Because when Mark Wahlberg revives Optimus Prime, you know, it's this rusty truck, he figures out that he's a Transformer, and he kind of jump-starts him. And Optimus Prime kind of, like, jerks into robot mode, and his first words are, "I'll kill you!"
Oops.
So it's established that Optimus, when he's in this rusty truck mode, he's dormant. He's hibernating, for lack of a better term. And he's just come from a near-death experience fighting lockdown. So the fact that, yeah, the first thing he'd say upon being woken up is, "I'll kill you." Like, you can see that this war has finally started to take its toll on Optimus Prime. And he comes around eventually. You know, Marky Mark talks him down. But the thing I'm getting at is that Marky Mark and Optimus Prime, they rendezvous with the four other remaining Autobots. And there's an entire scene dedicated to fleshing out these Autobot characters. Hound, Drift, Crosshairs, they all get significant amounts of dialogue. There was a joke online when they cast John Goodman as Hound and they cast Ken Watanabe as Drift. It's like, oh yeah, these are good actors, but you know, they're only going to probably have one or two lines and that'll be it.
Yeah.
But no, they get like full conversations. They get full characterization. You really get the sense. I'll just break it down right now. Drift is, he's samurai themed. He keeps calling Optimus Prime sensei.
Nice.
But, you know, aside from that, you do get the basics of his character. He's very honor-bound. He doesn't like – it's revealed that when Optimus was in hibernation, Bumblebee was sort of leading this ragtag group of Autobots, and they all kind of grudgingly accepted him as their leader, but they all hate Bumblebee as leader.
See, even the other Autobots know what you and I know, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Bumblebee is a useless fucking tool.
Yeah. No. When Optimus shows back up, Drift is ready to cut Bumblebee's throat. It's hilarious. And Crosshair's like, "I'll shoot him and then I'll be in charge."
Nice. And, someone needs to.
Crosshairs has the characterization. He is basically, he's an asshole. I'll say it right now. He is an asshole. He dual wields kind of these machine pistol kind of weapons. I'm not sure how they did it. I think he transforms into a convertible, and the cloth top of the convertible kind of forms like a trench coat in his robot mode.
Clever.
So he's got like a so he's kind of got a unique aesthetic. You know, he's kind of wearing a trench coat, got these dual pistols. He's kind of full of himself. Like, during the final battle, he says he and Bumblebee are in a spaceship. They're in, like, the small fighter craft evading Lockdown's minions. And he goes, "Bumblebee, take the wheel. I'm going to be dangerous." And then he jumps out of the back of this craft and, like, starts dual-wielding pistols as he's falling down.
Danger zone!
Exactly.
Well, you freaked out, Bumblebee, when I called you Quadroon.
Oh, God. Yeah, so Sterling Archer, if anyone watches the show, Archer, imagine Archer as sort of this trench coat-wearing giant robot, and that's Crosshairs. Voiced by Bender from Futurama.
Now, since that's this voice actor's main robot voice acting experience,
no,
is there
he does
any...
not sound like Bender. No,
that would have been awesome.
I wouldn't have been able to tell you it was John DiMaggio if I didn't know it beforehand. He kind of gives. I don't want to say it's a British accent, but it's sort of like a pseudo British accent. Like, you know how Carrie Fisher in the original Star Wars movie was trying to do a British accent?
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. Like, John DiMaggio's trying to do a British accent. You can tell that's what he's going for, but it's really not working. So it's kind of the pseudo-British robot dude.
Even if it was just the lines of "bite my shiny metal ass."
Yeah, that would have been great.
That would have been great.
Oh, fantastic. And then there's Hound, John Goodman, who honestly was my favorite robotic character in the movie. Hound, a lot of people, I know we've been kind of alluding that his design is more Bulkhead than Hound.
Yeah, which is the personality more like?
The personality, it's kind of neither. It's definitely not Bulkhead.
Because he's competent.
It's definitely not Bulkhead, but it's definitely not G1 Hound either. I would say it's kind of a new character kind of created from the ground up. He's covered in ammo belts, he's covered in grenades, and he's covered in guns. And again, he probably gets the most characterization out of the new characters. And, at the end, there's this big final battle, and they actually play off of his character design with all the ammo and all the grenades. And you see Hound throughout the battle, like, he's got the big gun, the gun runs out of ammo, he tosses it aside, he pulls out two other guns, he starts using those, he's tossing grenades. And at the end, he takes off a helmet, he takes off the top part of his head, and tosses it at a Decepticon.
So he's just a fucking badass,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah,
nice.
And, like, he falls down, like, exhausted, like, midway through this battle. And Mark Wahlberg's like, come on, Hound, get up, like, they're still coming. He's like, man, I'm running on empty. And it's a great character moment because, again, you're not expecting to feel anything for this character when the movie starts, but goddammit, they make you care about Hound, and they make you want to see Hound get up and kick more ass because they've done such a good job making that his character.
So on the human end of things now, the beef, as you call him.
The beef, he's gone.
Yeah, he's gone, of course. And a lot of people are happy about that. Now, in terms of on the human end of the equation holding up the movie, is Marky Mark an improvement?
Yes, he is. I'm going to say that I actually did not mind Shia LaBeouf in the first two movies.
I didn't either.
I thought he was perfect for the role in the first two. Revenge of the Fallen obviously had a lot of problems. Shia LaBeouf was not one of them, I didn't think. In the third one, you could tell, in my opinion, he kind of just seemed bored. Like, by the third one, you could tell he was kind of done with it. Marky Mark, and so this is coming from someone who has no real problem with Shia LaBeouf in and of himself. I thought Marky Mark was an improvement. Yeah.
So, now, okay, in this movie, Marky Mark is in Texas. Presumably, he's supposed to be a Texan.
Well, he has his Massachusetts accent, but yes, he is from
Texas. Okay, that's what I was about to ask you.
Yeah, he is a Texan, but he still talks like he's from Boston. Guys!
Nice.
Guys, I think we found a Transformer! Guys! Oh, God. But, yeah, so the human side of things. Marky Mark is very much the main human character. When he was first cast, what I was hearing was that he was going to be a side character and that the main human characters would be his daughter and his daughter's boyfriend.
Right.
It's very much the opposite of that situation. Marky Mark is the main human character, and then his daughter and his daughter's boyfriend are sort of the supporting human cast. There's a other character when the movie starts. Marky Mark's got he plays this inventor / handyman. And, you know, his assistant is this really annoying guy. He's this really annoying character. You know, he's the kind of character who's got this really comedic personality who you kind of laugh at for the first, like, 3 minutes, and then you're like, oh, God, this character's annoying afterwards. And he's sort of the character that you think, oh, this is the kind of annoying character Michael Bay's going to stick in the whole movie. No. Lockdown straight up murders this guy.
Murder, death, kill.
Yeah, I mean, this guy doesn't even make it out of Texas.
Damn.
So for a lot of people, so in a lot of ways, it's like you're thinking, like, has Michael Bay become aware of his faults and is he trying to correct them? Because you've got this annoying Bay-esque character, but, you know, he's gone. He's not dragging the movie down. Like, he's introduced, he has his role, and then he's dead. I was worried about the actress playing the daughter. Because, well, I think she was in Last Airbender. She was the princess from Last Airbender,
Okay, I gotcha.
And, that movie did not speak to very many of its participants' acting abilities. So I was a bit worried about that. I was a bit worried about that. She's fine. It's nothing, not a mind-blowing performance or anything, but she is capable of the material she's given. She's fine. Her boyfriend is, this Irish race car driver, which is funny because, you know, three of the main human characters are from Texas and two of them sound like they're not from Texas.
Nice. But
at least they acknowledge that the, boyfriend is from Ireland. Marky Mark keeps calling him Lucky Charms. And,
that's racist.
It's actually funny, like, when Mark Wahlberg first meets him, because he's, like, Mark Wahlberg's one of his big things in this movie is that he doesn't like his daughter dating. So his daughter has been seeing this guy behind her back, and they're all sort of thrust together because of this giant robot war that's happened. And, and so when they first meet, Marky Mark's like, "You sound like a leprechaun." And the guy is like, "Oh, in Ireland, you get your ass kicked for that." And Marky Mark's like, "Yeah, well, we're not in Ireland, Lucky Charms. We're in Texas." So that was funny. Moving on from there, there's another main human character, Stanley Tucci, I think. Tucci. Whatever. He plays the head of this independent military contractor who, as a result of the CIA deal with Lockdown, they're getting all the Cybertronian tech that Lockdown has commandeered. And so they're using this Cybertronian material to create their own Transformers. And he actually starts off as an antagonist, and he becomes a protagonist once he realizes what he's doing. Because one of the things, he creates Galvatron. And he got the technical information for Galvatron out of the severed head for Megatron that Optimus Prime decapitated Megatron at the end of Dark of the Moon. So he's got Megatron's head, and he's using it to get the technical specs to build Galvatron. And it's revealed that Megatron's still alive. He had his consciousness stored in his head, and then he secretly transferred it into Galvatron's body when Galvatron was being made. And he's been using it. He's been playing this company, because this company is going to make a ton of man-made Transformers, and then Galvatron, when the time is right, is going to reveal that he's really Megatron, and he's going to commandeer these man-made Transformers as his army. So he's been playing this company, and once the head of the company realizes that he's been played, he very quickly switches over to the good guy side of things.
Okay.
So yes, Galvatron is Megatron. And they really don't do a lot with him, actually. He raises his army, and he does attack the Autobots. But once Lockdown shows back up, it very much focuses to Optimus Prime versus Lockdown. And then Galvatron sort of fades away, and at the end they hint that, you know, he's retreated. At the end of the movie, Galvatron goes, "We'll meet again, Prime." So they're saving Galvatron for future movies. And the movie ends. Optimus Prime, the Dinobots, who were a huge part of the branding of this, only show up for the final battle. They are described as a ancient order of Cybertronian knights who sort of crashed on Earth during the time of the dinosaurs and took dinosaur forms, and now Optimus Prime is aware of them, and he sort of revives them to be part of this final battle because they need backup. So they're in at the final battle, but they're definitely not a big part of the movie. But I actually didn't mind because I went through most of the movie just sort of enjoying it, and then I realized, oh hey, Dinobots haven't shown up yet. So.
Okay, so now one of the things that we were promised with this movie was that it would be, I'm not sure what the exact phrase that was used, but overall that it would be a bit more adult oriented, a bit more mature than the previous installments.
I'd say it is. I would say it is. Maybe it's a sliding scale when it comes to Michael Bay, but the sexual, the sexual humor, there really is none. Anything that you could construe as sexual humor, comes down from Marky Mark being upset that his daughter's dating someone.
So there's no, you know, quick scene of a giant robotic T-Rex dong?
No.
Well, that's a relief.
There is one funny scene that kind of hints that I kind of want to see the backstory to this. The Autobots and the human cast are in hiding, and Marky Mark's daughter is, you know, lying on a couch with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend's got his arms around her, and Marky Mark's like, "Hey, cut it out, you two." And then Optimus Prime goes, "I went through the same thing with Bumblebee."
Alrighty then.
And like, oh god, what is the backstory there? Cause, and then, so there's that, and then there's, I think at one point, because his Mark's daughter is wearing Daisy Dukes, and at one point he's like, "Honey, wear some longer pants." So, like, there's stuff like that, but, in terms, like, there's no masturbation humor like there was in the first one. There's no real sexual, overly sexual humor or anything like that. And there were kind of cheesy, corny, funny, comedic lines, but I thought they worked. There was the one we talked about a few weeks back where Mark Wahlberg is piloting a spaceship that, like, crashes in some guy's car. And the guy's like, "You have insurance?" And Mark Wahlberg's like, "It's a spaceship!" Yeah. He's like, "Honey, get me my alien gun!" And so, you know, and yeah, that's a goofy line, but it's funny, and it's not anything near the level of the adolescent humor that had kind of penetrated the previous films. Like,
you said penetrated,
but like, okay, in the second one, you had Sam Witwicky's mom on with like the getting high on pot brownies, right?
Yeah,
there's none of that there. In the first one, you had when Sam is talking to Optimus Prime through his window and he's trying to keep his parents out of the room and they're like, "Are you masturbating?" No, there's none of that here. It's like there are still corny comedic bits, but they're not as adolescent or sophomoric, you know, whatever term you want to use. The product placement is very blatant. There's one scene, it's actually that you've got insurance scene. Mark Wahlberg crashes into this guy's car with his spaceship, and a Bud Light truck tips over and spills Bud Light bottles all over the street.
Oh my god, no.
And the camera lovingly pans across, like, the Bud Light bottles on the street.
No. It's mourning the loss.
So, it's like,
that's
the camera's focusing on these Bud Light bottles for like 5 seconds, and you're like, "Well, I don't know what's going on, but suddenly I'm in the mood for a delicious, refreshing Bud Light."
Yeah, which is kind of funny because movie theaters, most of them at least, don't serve beer.
But what else? Yeah, there's a really blatant Gucci ad where it zooms in on this once the movie shifts over to China. It zooms in on this Chinese guy wearing Gucci glasses, and like the Gucci logo is huge on the side of the glasses. And like the camera makes sure to catch the logo, so it's like Gucci. But honestly, you know what? Product placement is a thing. It's not something that is exclusive to the Transformers series. It's not something that the Transformers series can be blamed for. So it's just a movie thing. Well,
now you mentioned something just now, and this is something I've been wanting to get to.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you and I have discussed about this movie in the lead up to it was, and I think I've been a bit more vocally concerned about this than you've been, but you've expressed reservations about this as well. Both of us have kind of felt that China is the whole Chinese thing is being kind of shoehorned into this.
It is so shoehorned. Okay. Michael Bay got a lot of flack from the first three movies for basically pandering to the U.S. military. Yes.
Why would someone be upset about that?
Because they're saying, oh, it's glorifying military or it's jingoistic, it's overly militaristic, that sort of thing.
Oh, fuck them. Go on.
There is none of that here. Like, the military obviously has a presence in this movie because you really can't have giant robots throwing down in the middle of, the country and not have, you know, the military be involved.
Exactly.
So there is a military presence here, but unlike the first three, none of the main characters are soldiers. In the first three, you kind of had a good portion of the human cast were soldiers. That's not the case here. So the military pandering is not present in this movie, but it's been replaced by blatant China pandering. There's a point.
He puts the panda in pandering.
Oh God. But there's a part of the movie where they shift the action to China. And the basic setup is Optimus Prime is informed that this company that is working with the CIA in lockdown brutally murdered Ratchet, and that they are now melting Ratchet's head down for raw materials.
Oh no.
And Optimus is going like, they killed Ratchet! And he like storms head first into this facility. And then in the aftermath of that, they say, well, this facility's been compromised, we're moving operations to our Chinese facility. And then the action shifts over to China. Now here's the thing. They didn't have to do that. If they really felt the need to shift the location after Optimus attacks that base, they could have shifted it anywhere. There is nothing about China that dictates that this movie had to go to China. It is just there because of the Chinese market. And it gets really blatant when Optimus and Lockdown are throwing down in the middle of, it's Hong Kong. They're throwing down the middle of Hong Kong. And, they suddenly cut to these characters we've never seen before. They're members of the Chinese government. And it's like the minister of China's minister of defense. And he's like, we will protect Hong Kong, whatever the cost. And then there's like this scene where one of the characters has this bomb that will decimate Hong Kong and turn it into a giant mountain of raw Cybertronian metal. And he's got this bomb with him, and he's like, I need to get to the top of this building to be extracted. Well, he and his Chinese, I'm trying to figure out what she would be. She's like, I guess, business partner or liaison or Chinese lieutenant, whatever you want to call her. Like his business partner, essentially, who's this Chinese woman. She takes him to the elevator. She's like, okay, get to the top of the building. And then these two CIA agents pop out to try to get him. And then there's like this 2.5 minute scene, which is basically, it stops being a Transformers movie and becomes like a Chinese kung fu action movie.
Sure, why the fuck not?
So it's the Chinese pandering is extremely blatant. But, you know, yeah.
Now, and, okay, I'm going to explain a little bit here about why this has bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, China, though, I mean, let's face it, they're not really communists. They're communists in name only at this point.
Mm-hmm.
They're the exact opposite of what a true, quote-unquote, communist nation would aspire to be. They're pretty much now just a run-of-the-mill despotic dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And they do the same kind of shit that we, you know, do, you know, bitch about North Korea doing, the same kind of shit that, you know, we bitch about Middle Eastern countries doing, you know, your average dictatorship kind of shit. And, but with China, we always give them a pass.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, we're blatantly, you know, we're blatantly giving them a pass. You know, I don't mean to stick politics or geopolitical affairs into a movie. I know movies are meant for fun, and this sounds like it delivers on that big time. But oh, yeah. I'm just kind of giving the background as to why this kind of sticks in my craw a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you, okay, no, you can't do that kind of shit to people. You can't treat people like that unless you've got lots of money and help our economy, in which case, you know, here, have half of here's half of our movie dedicated to you guys. Love ya. That's why it bothers me. That's why it pisses me off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. The Chinese government is presented in a heroic light. Like, again, they cut to that, that defense minister's like, we will defend Hong Kong, whatever the cost. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, but you're also a despotic dictatorship, so.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want to get into this whole debate about American jingoism, but I'll be perfectly honest. From as someone who's not an American, from a purely moralistic standpoint, if I wanted to get all morally righteous with my giant alien robot fighting movies, I would take U.S. military pandering over pandering to the Chinese government any day of the week. It's not even a question. Whatever problems you might have with quote unquote American imperialism or the American military industrial complex, I'll take them over the People's Republic of China any day of the week, just in terms of who's got the moral high ground.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there definitely is that. And it's it's incredibly blatant what they're doing, but at the same time, I wouldn't say it's to the movie's detriment in any way, because at the same time, you still have well-done action scenes, you still have a plot that even though it suffers from the Michael Bay tendency of being a bit scatterbrained at times, it does seem more focused.
Mm.
It's a focused plot. All the bad guys have their motivations explained in a very non-expository manner. Everything feels natural. Nothing feels forced plot-wise. Characterization of the Autobots is excellent, far and away above anything we've seen from the previous three movies. And they leave us with a great cliffhanger, because not only do we have Galvatron still being out there, but at the end of the movie, Optimus Prime says, like, he basically says, even though lockdown's gone, our creators still have put a price on my head.
So now, why do they want him?
They don't.
Does that ever explain? Okay.
They don't explain it, but here's why I think it works. Because at the end of the movie, Optimus says, I'm putting Earth in danger as long as I stay here. So he actually takes off his new robot form that he assumes for this movie has built-in propulsion. So he's able to, like, kind of rocket off. And so he lifts off, and the movie ends with him saying, like, this is a message to our creators. You will leave Earth alone because I'm coming for you.
Oh, shit, son.
So that's why.
And when I get there, your faces shall be mine.
Give me your face! But, yeah, I mean, that's sort of the thing where the creators are very much part of the backdrop to this movie. And they don't even explain who or what they are. And they don't and you only see a very brief glimpse of them in the movie at the very beginning of the movie. There's a flashback sequence, and you see a brief glimpse, a very brief glimpse, and you really can't even make anything out. But the reason why I'm okay with them never really explaining the creator's motives is because the movie is structured in such a way that it makes it clear that that's what's coming next.
Right.
So we will know why the creators want Optimus back. Lockdown does drop a few hints about why. The biggest thing is Lockdown goes to Prime. He goes, this war that you've brought to Earth, this intermixing with the species of the universe, the creators say it upsets the balance. And that's just like cryptic villain talk. I don't know if you can read much in terms of motivation out of that. But that's sort of the best we get in terms of why the creators want Optimus Prime back.
I gotcha.
One more thing I wanted to point out. This is a Michael Bay Transformers movie. There has been a lot of discussion and division over it. I'm just going to lay down some cold, hard numbers. The movie came out Friday. It is now Saturday. It is now Sunday. In just the United States alone, it has made $150 million. Worldwide, it's made $301,300,000. This movie, I don't know if it's going to break Dark of the Moon's $1 billion mark. I don't know if it will, but this movie is fucking owned at the box office. It is, it has surpassed Godzilla. It has surpassed, Spider-Man 2. It has surpassed X-Men Days of Futures Past. This is, it has surpassed Captain America. This is the highest grossing, this has had the largest opening weekend of any movie in 2014. This movie is rolling in the box office. So to everyone who said that the general public was tired of Bay's Transformers movies, or everyone who was saying that Michael Bay needs to go, you know what? No, I'll go even further than what I was saying a few months back, where I was kind of saying, yeah, you know what? Love him or hate him, he's done good for the franchise. No. Not only are his Transformers movies continuing to bring money into the franchise, which even if you hate the guy, you cannot deny, but I'd say at this point, it's clear that whether it's just through trial and error, maybe he's got more competent people working with him this time around, but whatever the case might be, it is clear that from this movie that Michael Bay can make a live-action Transformers movie that pays, that gives the robotic characters enough respect to develop as characters, gives us human characters who don't drag the movie down all too badly, and gives us a movie that, with a plot that, while it is a bit scatterbrained, is generally coherent and focused. No, keep Michael Bay on. Get him for the next two movies, because if he can make two more movies that are like this one, sure, definitely, bring him on. It'll be nothing but a boon to this franchise. And again, I say this as someone who is expecting to come out of Age of Extinction going, eh, it was good for what it was. But no, it is legitimately a good movie. It's legitimately a good popcorn movie.
Well, there we go. Well, at least, you know, for the most part, you know, I know going into this I had more reservations about the movie than you did. I'm glad to hear that they're not true. I'm glad to hear that I was wrong or overly concerned or whatever.
Sophomoric humor is gone. Cheesy humor is generally well done. Good characterization. I think you'll enjoy it when you get around to it.
So now moving on, we do have some other one other piece of Transformers related thing to discuss.
Yes, you got the beta. You got into the beta for Transformers Universe, the MOTA that was an MMO and is no longer one.
I did. And, you know, I made this promise many, many episodes ago that, you know, saying basically, you know, I'd applied for the beta. If I got into it, it would have 2 hours to impress me. I've gotten through probably an hour and a half of that 2 hours, so I'm going to go ahead and say my piece on it now. And if, you know, if I learn something about this game that drastically changes my opinion or influences it, then, you know, I'll update in another episode. Mm-hmm. This game does not know what it wants to be.
How so?
Well, okay. So last night I got the email saying, congratulations, Commander, you've gotten into the Transformers Universe beta.
Huh?
Yes, yes, indeed. Moving up in the world. But, so I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, and when I got back from the venerable trip to Wally World, I fired it up and took a look at it. And, okay, here's the thing. The game is in beta. So, I mean, you know, a lot of people will say, well, you know, if a game's in beta, you can't be too hard on it because it's not finished.
Mm-hmm.
90% of the time, I would agree with that.
Okay.
But this game is... It has opened the doors for business. It is taking money if you're willing to give it.
Yeah, you can pay $500 for a year subscription.
Right.
Which is ridiculous when paying that much money. Well, actually paying $200 less for $300, you can get a lifetime subscription to Star Trek Online.
Right. And now when we say subscription, we don't mean like World of Warcraft subscription. The game is free to play. I did not pay anything to get into this beta.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you get whatever for that money. But they have opened the doors for business to take money. So as far as I'm concerned, if you're taking people's money, then I'm treating you as a release version.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fair. That being said, you know, I've got my problems with it.
Okay. You said you said that you didn't know what it wanted to be.
Right. The game, it you can see traces of its MMO roots in the game. Like, for example, when you first go into the game, you get a tutorial, which is in kind of a semi-open world. The first stage, the tutorial for the game has this open questing zone feel to it a little bit.
Mm.
Except, you know, you don't click and accept a quest, you're just told what to do and you go do it. But it does have that kind of, like, questing MMO feel to it. Once you get past that, you go into this, this base, this Autobot base, and it looks like the one from Transformers Prime. And you're in there and you see all these other players running around you just like you would if you were in Stormwind.
Mm-hmm.
Again, another thing that's very, very MMO-ish. You've got your PvP battles, or you can go and... Now, I'm a little bit unclear on how this part works. I'm going to look more into this. And if it's anything different from what I'm saying it is, then I'll update in another episode. But it's like this, almost like a PvE type area where you can go and just like kill, Terracons, whatever. And the thing is, the textures in that area, in that open area, like what I'm believing to be a PvE area,
mm-hmm.
are horrible. The graphics in that area are horrible. I mean, it looks more dated than World of Warcraft.
And World of Warcraft is a game that is 9, going on 10 years old.
Yeah, it looks like something from, I don't know. So now, in WoW's defense, to add fairness to this argument, WoW has had a few overhauls graphically since then. It gets one almost every expansion. But that being said, you know, this looks like a game, you know, this part of the game looks like something from, I don't know, 5 years ago. It's not impressive. The loading times are pretty bad. And when you're in the base with the other characters, with the other players, the server lag is horrible. I changed my graphic settings thinking, okay, well, you know, my computer, it can hold its own, but it's not, you know, a beast machine, mm-hmm. no pun intended. So I'm like, yeah, I'll lower the graphics. Nope, still same thing. So it's a server issue. It's not anything on my end.
Now, you mentioned that the base is reminiscent of the Autobot base from Transformers Prime, the TV show.
Yes.
Now, The reason I bring, the reason why I want to bring that up is, as a quick side note, I've been watching reviews done by the internet personality named Vangelis. He's been posting interviews that he did at BotCon. And he interviewed, the representative that the developers of this game called Jagex sent to BotCon. And I was listening to that interview. And, he asks the Jagex guy, well, you know, the game hasn't even really launched yet officially, and the Prime show was already over. And your character models have a very Prime feel to it. Your game has a very Prime feel to it.
Right.
And it goes like, how is that going to affect it now that, you know, but the show's over and you haven't even launched yet? And the Jagex guy responded saying, well, we started off as a Prime game, but we've really divorced ourselves from that and we're really doing our own thing.
Bullshit.
Bullshit?
Bullshit. I mean, dude, if you could see the space, I mean, it looks pretty much identical. No, I won't say identical. It's, but when you see it, you know where the influence came from. There's no divorcing to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're inside of a goddamn mountain, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, that is the Autobot.
And you've even got the fucking gate there that you come out of when you get out of a PvP mission.
Oh yeah, yeah, the land bridge, yeah.
Yeah, the land bridge. Yeah, you have that you come out of. Yeah, no, it's very Transformers Prime, and the character models are Transformers Prime. And that's something else. Now, the textures on the actual character models are good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things look all metallic-y and robot-y, and it's cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give it a thumbs up for that. Gameplay-wise, there seems to be a lot of depth to it. You can customize your loadout on your bots and all that other shit. Then there seems to be a lot of depth there that you could get if you're a fan of the MOBA-style gameplay, which honestly, admittedly, I'm not. So everything I'm saying, kind of view through this filter. I'm trying to be as objective as possible about this and the game that we'll be talking about after this. But there does seem to be a lot of depth there that you can get to. Now the actual gameplay in the PvP missions or in the PvP battles against the Decepticons, the controls on the whole feel kind of clunky. They feel kind of the navigation feels kind of counterintuitive to me, at least. But again, another caveat on that, I'm used to kind of like WoW style controls, and with a MOBA, I'm used to League of Legends style controls.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't really do any of those. So the actual combat, that notwithstanding, feels kind of clunky to me. Is it fun? It is what it is. I wasn't blown away. It felt mediocre. It didn't blow me away. It didn't change my mind about anything. Some may find it enjoyable. It's solid enough, I guess. It feels like it needs fine tuning. It feels like it needs tweaking. And I guess they will do that. But again, they're taking people's money, you know, for things associated with this game now. You know, I don't know. It's the one thing that turks me off the most about this game, though, is the characters, the bots. Okay. So, you know, we discussed last episode or episode before that they created these bots using assets that were originally created.
Yeah.
Back when this game was an MMO.
Yeah, it was originally an MMO. They had the character creation art assets in place, and when they switched it over to MOTA, they couldn't just dump all that time and money.
Right, exactly. And I understand that. And this game, you can play this game for a few minutes and tell that it has its roots in an MMO. Except it's kind of like it feels exactly like what it is, an abandoned MMO that decided it wanted to be something else.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to have a few elements of both, and it doesn't seem to do either one of them exceptionally. The MOBA, it's a goddamn MOBA. The MOBA end of things seems to be a lot more polished out and with a lot more thought into it, but the MMO side looks even unfinished when you go into that PvE area.
Mm-hmm.
But these character design assets that they had, god damn it. Okay, so you decide you want to go the MOBA route. All right, that's all well and good. You know, so then let's go the heroes route, because that's what these games all do. I mean, look at Heroes of the Storm. You know, it's like a Blizzard roster of who's who. Let's have Optimus Prime. Let's have Ultra Magnus and even goddamn Bumblebee. But no, you don't get that. You get these goddamn generic ass bots.
That was another thing, actually, in that interview with the Jagex guy. He was asked about the cast of original characters, and he goes, "Well, we thought that if we used the characters like Optimus and Bumblebee, that everyone would just play as them." Their excuse is that by having these original characters, it gives them more freedom to do what they want, and they say it gives the players more freedom to choose who they want to be.
Okay, I'm going to gloss over my rebuttal to this before I give you what I was going to say, which is my solution to this, where they could have had their way and we could have had ours.
Okay.
One, I call bullshit. They're underestimating the TF community on that. And let's face it, this is who this is kind of aimed at.
Oh, I'd say it's entirely who it was aimed at. And
I mean, like, okay, yeah, you, for example, if you could play as Optimus Prime or Ultra Magnus, but you also have the chance to play as Chrome Dome or Rewind,
mm-hmm.
I would be willing to bet which one you'd go for.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, with the MOBA, you're always switching characters. It's not about necessarily who you're playing.
Rewind's a historian. That would go poorly in a fighting game.
Well, you know, whatever. I'm just saying, for sake of argument, though.
Yeah.
You play the class. You don't necessarily play the character. And though, while Jagex could use that to justify their decision, I've got something that would have solved all of this shit if they just fucking done it. Let us make our own. You've got the goddamn character creation assets in place.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give us these goddamn generic ass bots that we have no interest in these guys. We don't know shit about them. But if you let us make our own, then you have that player investment. You have that player, you know, you care about that because this is your guy. You made this guy. This is you as a Transformer. This is, you know, whatever, however you want to view it. And then they would have gotten to have still used their character creation model as an integral part of the game. You could have just, you know, gone in and picked your class, and then, you know, they could have used that as things to charge money for. Different parts components to add on for aesthetics, and then now they do have paint schemes in the game that you can buy. But, you know, they could have done that, offering different customization options for the character maker and things like that. And they could have separated the aesthetics from the mechanics enough to where, you know, you could have made your own and it wouldn't have been imbalanced. But they didn't. They give us this shit instead. And that pisses me off more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a half-brained idea. I can tell, I mean, in terms of the combat and mechanics, I can't tell they put a lot of thought into it. I just don't think it's going to really appeal to anybody. I mean, who is this?
So, the thing that comes to mind for me is, remember when Chinese Democracy came out, album 14 yeah. Years in the Making?
Quote unquote, it feels overproduced.
No, exactly. you know, Chinese Democracy comes out and I'm listening to them discuss it on the radio. And someone goes, well, you know, it sounds overproduced. And it's like, oh, well, you know, knowing what we know about this album, that is not surprising at all. But 14 years in production, of course, it sounds overproduced. So it kind of seems like that's the same thing with this game. Like, we know it was an MMO. We know it became a MOTA. And from everything you're telling me, it sounds exactly like that. A game that was once an MMO that became a MOTA.
Yeah. That's pretty much what it is. I mean, it doesn't do everything wrong. It doesn't really do anything wrong in terms of gameplay, except, like I said, it does feel a little clunky. It just doesn't do it spectacularly well either. Uh-huh. You know, you can get the same experience just by doing any kind of third-person shooter in multiplayer. Mm-hmm. And you get the same experience and probably even better. I don't... There's nothing compelling a gamer to not play League of Legends and come to this game. There's nothing compelling a gamer from playing, you know, whatever third-person shooter that they're playing on multiplayer and coming to this game, unless you're just a big Transformers fan. But then, wait, no, you shoot that in the fucking foot, too, because you can't make your own. You can't play as any of the well-known characters in the franchise. So that at least cuts that appeal alone in half.
Yeah,
what is there here?
I know, kind of just from reading posts that when this was an MMO, a lot of people who are into the, sorry about that. A lot of people who are into the role play side of things were really interested in the idea of creating their own Transformers characters and kind of having this role play, game. You know, MMO, RPG, multi something online role playing game.
Yeah. Right.
That's what they were interested in. But now, you know, oh, if it's going to be a MOTA, then obviously that's out the window. But then the big appeal of a MOTA is, oh, I can play as Optimus Prime or Megatron or whoever. But now you can't even do that. So I'm kind of, when you tell me that, I kind of think, well, who is this game trying to appeal to? Who is the market for this game?
It doesn't know. It doesn't feel like it knows. And, you know, maybe I'm being unfair. I don't think I am, though. I've tried to be, you know, I played around with it for a good bit last night and some again today. Mm-hmm. And I'll continue to play some more of it because I want to make sure. But this is where it stands right now. I feel that it's a decent game. It's a competent game. But it doesn't do anything. It doesn't do any one thing well enough to give anyone really a reason to play it.
Yeah, you can't create your own characters, so the roleplay community is not going to be into it. But you can't play as, you know, the iconic characters from the franchise, so, you know, the MOTA fans aren't going to be interested in it. So it just seems out there and empty, and I can't even respect the people who made the game. Cause I was telling you, I watched that interview with the Jagex guy at BotCon. Well, I could tell only, maybe 15 minutes into this interview that the guy, was full of crap and he was just spewing marketing BS, and I stopped listening to it because I knew that that Vangelis, the guy doing the interviewing, wasn't going to get a real answer out of him.
Well, no, of course he's not. I mean, none of these guys anymore with any company, not just Jagex, none of them spout any real information on their games anymore. It's all just a fucking collection of talking points.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Aliens, Colonial Marines, again, a perfect example. All these goddamn talking points about fourth-gen lighting and all this other bollocks, and you get the actual game and it's a goddamn piece of shit. I wouldn't call this a piece of shit. It's almost worse in the sense that it's like Star Trek Insurrection. It's forgettable. I mean, you play it, it's a thing that happens, and then you're done.
Mm-hmm.
It's neither spectacular nor terrible, and it's not going to stand out in your mind as either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they'll do something different. Maybe, you know, I at least hope that they work on those controls. I wouldn't say it feels unresponsive. It feels very slow. And maybe their mindset is, oh, well, you know, you're a giant robot. You're going to be slow. Well, that's all well and good, but it doesn't make for good gameplay. And in the movies, you know, they fly around and move quickly. And in Transformers Prime, they move, you know, these bots can move quickly. Let's have a little more quickness in the game. And yeah, you can transform. That's one thing they did get right. The feeling when you're in vehicle mode and you fly into battle and you transform and you're just flying through the air transforming and you land and you're starting shooting. That is perfect. That is spot on. They did that brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very satisfying feeling. And you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to whoop ass. And you think that for like half a second until you're dead. At least, well, if you're as bad as me, but you know, they did that right. If you've played War for Cybertron or Fall of Cybertron, it feels very similar in that respect to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, they got that much right. That being said, there's, again, I guess you could say my final thoughts on our, you know, it's a competent game. It's a decent game. They had a lot of missed opportunities that they could have done to make it a really memorable, engaging experience for the player that they passed on.
That's kind of a shame to hear, but it's not all that unsurprising to hear, knowing what I do about the complicated and disingenuous history of this game's development. I guess we're going to move on to a much better made MOTA or MODA or whatever you want to call it. Because in addition to getting into the beta for Transformers Universe, you got, is it the alpha or the beta for?
The alpha for Heroes of the Storm.
Alpha for Heroes of the Storm. This is Blizzard's MOTA using the characters from Blizzard's franchises. So tell us about this one.
Yeah, Heroes of the Storm, or as I've jokingly called it, League of Blizzard Legends, it is an alpha, and they're not inventing new words here. They're just calling it a MOBA. It is in the alpha, and it feels polished. It feels like a release game, which is, again, what I'm going to treat it as, because Blizzard is also taking money for it at this point. So I'm going to, you know, do the same thing on this. If you're going to take money, then I'm going to treat you as a release game. And it feels polished. Mm-hmm. I can tell, like, with the intro and the setup, there's some things that they're still working on. Some of the interface seems to not quite be as intuitive as it maybe would be in a finished product. But that's all things that are forgivable and things that you can kind of, you can still figure out where you're going. They got the tutorial in place. And it's pretty well done. You know, they put you on the regular, you know, like an actual field, and you practice using your moves and such. It's got a format almost identical to League of Legends. You've got your champions roster, which in this case are, you know, famous Blizzard characters.
I know Uther's in it. He's wearing Justice armor.
Well, I think the Justice set, Justice. I got that confused for Judgment. What I'm actually doing, I'm actually pulling up the game here for a second because I'll give you the roster rundown.
Mm-hmm.
And for anyone who says I'm being unfair to TF Universe on this because I didn't go over the character roster, they're all generic bots and you wouldn't have known the goddamn names anyways if I called them out. So
mm-hmm.
I'm doing this because these are names that, you know, Blizzard fans will recognize.
Mm-hmm.
So give me just a sec. I need to mute this really quick. I apologize for the background noise. Okay, so let's take a look here. I'm just going to do a practice mode here. Okay, so now, usually these games do a hero rotation. Every week you have a certain set you can choose from to play for free unless you buy the other characters either through in-game points that you earn from grinding matches or just pay out with cash. Your default hero that you get is Jim Raynor from StarCraft. And he's, you know, he's pretty decent. This week you have Malfurion, Sergeant Hammer, who I'm believing is from StarCraft.
Mm-hmm.
Vala, who I believe is a demon hunter from Diablo 3. Sonya, I believe she's from StarCraft, maybe. I'm probably getting some of these wrong. And Illidan Stormrage, of course, from World of Warcraft. Now you have Arthas, Abathur, Brightwing, who he looks a little bit like a Murloc in the picture, but that, you know,
mm-hmm.
Diablo, Falstad, who is a dwarf from World of Warcraft, ETC, who is a Tauren, Gazlo Kerrigan from StarCraft, Lili, who's a Pandaren,
Muradin. Put Lili in the game, did they?
Yeah. Muradin, again, another dwarf from World of Warcraft, Murky the Murloc.
Yes.
Yes, that's a thing.
I'll play as Murky all the time.
Nova, a Protoss named Tassadar, Tyrael from Diablo, Uther, of course, Zeratul, who I think he's a Zerg, can't really tell from the picture. Tyrande, and looks like Tychus, I think he's from StarCraft as well. Stitches, the Abomination from World of Warcraft. So you have a pretty decent, you know, roster here. Now, the first ones that I mentioned are the ones that are playable this week unless you, you know, purchase them with, points or cash that you earn through playing. So they have a pretty decent starting roster here, and probably what they're going to do is the same thing that Riot's done with League of Legends, and every 2 to 3 months you'll see a new one pop up.
Yeah, you know, I look forward to playing as Gen Greymane.
Lol. Now, gameplay-wise, it feels a little bit different than League of Legends. It feels a little more open in the matches. You can, it's not just necessarily your lane. You have a better sense of, at least to me personally, as a player, you have a better feel for what's going on around you. Not like you're just isolated in your own little lane. It's like, it's me and my lane kind of a feeling. You have a bit more of a holistic feel to everything.
Well, didn't they say that they wanted Heroes of the Storm to be sort of a MOTA for casuals that wouldn't necessarily have the hardcore League of Legends fan base?
Well, in this case, it's MOBA. MOTA is just this cockamamie term that Jagex uses.
See, yeah,
for...
I don't even know which. It's MOBA, MOTA, whatever.
MOBA, Multi-Online Battle Arena. And, yeah, they intended to be a more wide-ranging player base, or aiming it for, you know, casual players as well. They want anyone basically to sit down and be able to play it. Now, I have played co-op games against computer opponents. I haven't done a PvP game yet with this. I will now, you know, because I want to test the community and see how it is. And that's one thing I'll say, touching briefly on TF Universe again for just a second, because I forgot to say this earlier. In my matches, there was no, oh my god, you suck, L2 play, noob, kind of garbage going on. Everyone was civil. In fact, no one really said much of anything. So there's that, at least in that
Everyone was too busy bitching at each other about Michael Bay movies.
Probably. Rumble's red. But yeah, so and same thing for this game. In the couple matches I've played with human players, there hasn't been any, you know, oh my god, you suck, L2 play noob kind of shit, though it may come in time.
And before anyone says, oh, these are alpha and beta versions, keep in mind that you get a lot of assholes in the alpha and beta versions of World of Warcraft.
Yeah, and well, I mean, even comparing, you know, apples to apples here, I was in the beta or alpha it was for Heroes of New Earth several years ago, and oh my god, those people were fucking cock nuggets. Holy fucking shit. They would have bitched out their own mother. But I love you, Johnny. Your love doesn't win lanes, mother. You know. So, you know, that's not necessarily going to be the case. So far, the community in both of these games has been pretty good in terms of quiet and not harassing the fuck out of everybody. So, you know, gameplay-wise, in terms of control, again, I have my problems with this, too. The movement feels a bit weird, and I'm kind of getting used to the stop and attack and everything with this. It's not... Again, it's not as smooth or well done in that sense as League of Legends. At least it doesn't feel like that to me. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's just a thing where you kind of have to get used to it. And, you know, I'll probably need to try a few more characters to get a better idea of what's going on with that. As it stands now, though, it doesn't feel as smooth or as natural as it does in League of Legends. So that's something that might could be worked on a little bit or have been done differently. I'm pretty sure that control-wise, at least for Heroes of the Storm, I don't think there's going to be any major changes made between now and, you know, official release, except for balancing. Because Blizzard, I mean, once they put something out there and start letting people play it, they're pretty much done with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at that point, for them, knowing Blizzard the way I do, it's just a matter of tweaking at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good game. I, on the whole, I do actually like it better than League because you have, you know, more than one map for starters. That's a fucking plus. And maybe this is my own part, you know, me being partial. I like playing with the Blizzard characters. I know them. I know the graphical style of the game. You know, as soon as you go into it, you feel right at home if you're used to World of Warcraft or any Blizzard game, really. You feel right at home with it. You're in familiar surroundings, kind of. You can kind of definitely, when you're looking at it, you're like, yeah, this is a Blizzard game. And that helps it, to me at least. Now, for others, it may not. So that's very much subjective.
Well, from what I gather, you know, the whole MOTA, whatever you want to call it, a part of the appeal of these games is coming in and playing as choosing from a cast of characters that you know and appreciate. And if Blizzard fans play Heroes of the Storm, they're going to get exactly that. But if they were to play, say, Transformers Universe, they're not. You're not going to get it. So it seems that at least Blizzard knows what exactly this game is and what audience they want for it.
Yeah. And now performance-wise, I've had no issues on my machine running this. And my PC, it's not a piece of shit. But it's not a beast either. It's a very middle-of-the-road kind of a PC. I've had no issues with it. I'm running it on high graphics settings. And everything's been very smooth and you know, responsive. I haven't had any lag. I haven't been having any disconnects. The servers, you know, are fine. They're stable. So I haven't had any issues with that either on this. You know, and again, you know, you're talking about the character roster. Well, now this game actually had its origins in a little thing, a little pet project Blizzard was working on called Blizzard All-Stars.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that is also reflected in the final product because that's kind of what you're getting. You're getting, you know, a bit of an all-star list with some padding here and there because you got to have, you know, a lot of heroes for a game like this. It's required. It's part of the genre. But I mean, on the whole, yeah, you've got a lot of big names here. I mean, so there's that. And I'm pleased with that. I on the whole, I would say it's worth checking out. I don't think if you're like a hardcore League player, that there's necessarily going to be anything here to take you away from that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're a hardcore League player that loves World of Warcraft, or any Blizzard franchise and be like, you know, I'd like to do this with Blizzard stuff, then here you fucking go.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be in heaven with this because it plays pretty much the same aside from some control differences. If you're a person who doesn't like MOBAs but likes Blizzard stuff, which is actually kind of me in this, I would pretty much fall into that demographic. It's worth looking into. I haven't, you know, I'm not saying this game has sold me on the genre. I'm not saying anything of the sort. I'm saying that Transformers Universe sure as hell isn't going to. This one might. I'm going to play around with it some more again and kind of get some more impressions and more ideas on it as I go on. But I'll be of the two games, I'm going to play TF Universe just long enough to cement my opinion, make sure I haven't been unfair to it. And then if everything holds true, then I'm probably going to shelve it. This one I could see me going back and playing more of.
Indeed. Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Well, I definitely look forward to hearing more of your opinions on this. Transformers Universe, I've got to say, the more I learn about it, the more I kind of don't care to play it. But Heroes of the Storm, I could definitely see myself giving a test drive to see how well I like it. The whole MOTA, whatever, that whole thing, it's never been my cup of tea, but with Blizzard, with a cast of characters that I like and I know, I'm more inclined to try it out. You know, by that same token, I should be eager to try Transformers Universe, but they're not giving me a cast of characters who I know. So
they done cock that shit up.
Yeah, so, you know, misstep number one on that end. But I guess we're leaving the video game discussion in the dust for a bit because Bad Movie Public Defender is back.
Oh, yeah.
And today, Jack here will be defending Speed Racer.
I will be indeed. So I'm going to ask for a list of charges against this movie because going into it, you know, I didn't know that it was on the list of bad movies. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd seen most of it before, rewatched it this week, and I recognized evidently I'd caught like the last 20 minutes of it is what had happened initially. So what has this movie been derided for mostly?
Over-reliance on CGI. I believe that during the racing scenes, Speed Racer's car is the only car that actually existed as a prop or as a physical object. Every other car in the racing scenes was CGI'd in.
Okay.
Overemphasis on CGI, weak script, weak characterization, and just overly, like... It seems strange for people to complain about this, considering that the movie is an adaptation of an anime. But one of the things that I've heard was that it is way too overly cartoony, that it was too much of a straight adaptation. They didn't do enough to try to make it stand alone as a movie.
Okay.
So, those are the charges. Those are the ones that come to mind, the problems I heard people have the movie. And, I guess I'll start off the first thing. I found the overly CGI nature a bit of a distraction. The big problem a lot of people, myself included, have with the Star Wars prequels was that almost everything was filmed against a green screen. In that, even when you have characters just standing inside of the Jedi Temple, there was no Jedi Temple set. It was just a green screen. They filled it all in the background. And as a result, it doesn't look like a movie. It looks like a video game. And that's sort of the same problem with Speed Racer that I had, was that just sort of watching it, I kind of felt like I'm watching live action actors interact in a video game. I'm not watching a movie.
You know, that was actually kind of one of the things that I liked about it.
Okay.
The thing that struck me as being impressive about this movie was the visual styling of it. It was very distinctive. It was very vivid. And it was very immersive, more importantly. It was extreme, to me at least, it was extremely immersive. You had this very coherent kind of color scheme in the movie that wrapped around everything, and it kind of, the way the scenes were done, every scene, you know, every set had some, it did not let you forget where you were, that you were in this world they had made, you know, around this story. And that's what I really liked about it, actually. The racing scenes were brilliant. And, you know, honestly, the other cars being CGI, who gives a shit? I mean, goddamn Jurassic Park. Everything was – all the fucking dinosaurs were CGI. Why? Because we don't have real fucking dinosaurs.
Yes,
now, we do have real cars,
exactly.
Yes. But we don't have cars that can do what these fucking cars do, and not on these fucking tracks either like they have in this movie. So what the fuck were they going to do?
I guess the idea was that it just seems so overly stylized that having some actual props on hand and having having some actual physical sets as opposed to green screening most of the movie like they did would have helped a lot. Would have helped a lot in terms of avoiding sensory overload. That was another big thing I heard a lot of people had trouble with, was that there's so much CGI sort of just flying at you, and there's so much computer animation, there's so much that they try to pack in visually into every scene, that, you know, the human eye and the human mind can only process so much before it all just sort of becomes this blank blob of computer-generated imagery, and you just kind of get exhausted almost from watching it because you don't know what you're supposed to be trying to keep an eye on.
Okay, I'm going to call bullshit on that because of the simple fact I know what happens when that line is crossed. That's actually been some of my beef with the Michael Bay Transformers movies, especially the first one. You know, half of it when I was there in the theater, it's like, okay, I can't even notice, I can't even like discern what the fuck is going on here. It's just mechanical fucking blobs blowing shit up. And this movie did not have that. I mean, yes, the action was fast paced, but at no point did I have to stop and ask myself, what's going on here? You know, I knew. And again, it kind of fit in with the act. This movie had to be stylized to that degree. It wasn't going to stand out otherwise. If you didn't, it would have just been a generic run-of-the-mill fucking kiddie racing movie or what the hell ever, and it would have been mediocre. They made it stand out. This movie knew what it wanted to be, and it fucking went for it. It did not hold back. It put itself out there, and it did not take any half measures whatsoever. And I applaud that personally. You know, how many movies have we seen in our lives where it's like, you know, it kind of wanted to do this, but it felt like they had cold feet, so they pulled back a bit? No. None of that shit going on here. This movie knows what it is, and it's not ashamed of it, and it flaunts it. And that may be a bit much for some people, but I think it worked very well. It was presented expertly. The directing was great. The scenes were great. The action was awesome. It worked.
Okay. What you had to say about the fact that the characters themselves are pretty one-dimensional? And again, being somewhat familiar with the anime that Speed Racer, that the movie was based off of, the anime, of course, is kind of renowned for being cheaply made and cheaply dubbed over to for consumption for Western audiences. But at the same time, this is a cinematic movie. This is something that is that should aspire, in terms of characterization, it should aspire beyond just being something for Saturday mornings for kids. And at the same, but they never really went that way. Everyone is, like, the villain, Royalton, is so cartoonishly evil that it...
But he's a goddamn Englishman, and he's goddamn proud of it.
Yeah, but, you know, at the same time, like, I mean... he was... I just caught the V for Vendetta reference. Yeah. he was Porthro, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, for Viva Vendetta, yeah. The guy you said I reminded you of, which I'm not sure how to take. but yes, kind of getting back on track, you know, the characters seem like they're pulled right out of the anime, and while this kind of stuff may work for an anime that's primarily made for Saturday mornings, for consumption by kids, you know, if they're going to adapt it into a cinematic movie, if they're going to make this something that's going to be released in theaters and it's going to be consumed by the general movie-going audience, audiences today, they expect more out of the characters. And they expect more out of characterization. And this movie just seemed content to leave it at the bare bones from the show, and that was kind of disappointing.
Okay. First thing I'm going to say is... who in their right goddamn mind goes to a Speed Racer movie for characterization?
Well, I mean, that's the argument. Like, the anime, obviously, the show should have strived for something more, I guess, is the argument.
I have never watched more than maybe 5 minutes one time of the anime. I didn't like it. I'm like, what the fuck? This is garbage. And I shut it off. This was different. I mean, this was, you know, okay. Any idiot should be able to know, even if you don't even know of the anime, you should be able to just hear the word Speed Racer and know it's not going to be motherfucking Citizen Kane. All right? I mean, God damn it, people. Temper your expectations. Really, don't be so elitist and high on your own fucking farts. Get with the goddamn program, really? I mean, all right. this movie, again, this is another case of people placing unfair expectations on a movie that is meant for to be fun. And that is what this movie is trying to be. No, it's not trying to be a Saturday morning cartoon. It's trying to be a Saturday night movie. And that's what it is. You know, they did attempt some characterization there. And from what I'm hearing, based on the anime, they actually moved mountains with that because Speed Racer, yeah, he's a bit of an idiot. But, you know, you have this whole thing, his brother died and Racer X.
But did he?
Right, exactly. which I thought that was a kind of a cool take on it, you know, whatever. It showed that they gave enough of a fuck to write something that might be kind of interesting when there wasn't cars flying around on screen. But fortunately, for most of the movie, cars are flying around on screen. And though I didn't sit there with a stopwatch, I can at least say that my impression of the movie, I remember that a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I can walk away from the movie saying, you know, that movie was not a waste of my time. That was actually a fun movie. And because I remember cars flying around and doing crazy shit. And that's what you're going to this movie for. Really? You're going to Speed Racer for fucking characterization? Fuck you. You're an idiot. Get over yourself. I mean, I guess maybe if you grew up with the anime, you might be like, oh, I would have liked to have seen a bit more. But if you, why would you be at that point, I'm forced to question why you were a fan of the anime. I mean, even I know that Speed Racer, the anime, has a reputation for just being, you know, really thrown together kind of shit. It wasn't meant to be quality entertainment by any stretch of the imagination.
No, it was not.
And really, I mean, it's going to be – I feel like it's going to be one of those animes that for someone who grew up watching it, if they go back and revisit it like our age, you're going to be like, oh, well, at least I have memories.
Yeah.
And this movie, at least you can sit and you can watch it, and it feels like – I mean, it's not shittily thrown together. It's not haphazardly done. You know, they had in mind a very clear image of what they wanted to do. They had a very concise vision of what they wanted this movie to accomplish, and it did. You know, whether you like that, whether you don't like that, that's on you. That's not the movie is what it is in this particular case. There was no obvious flaws of. You know, it blatantly disregarded this, that, or the other thing. It wasn't like, you know, well, they tried to do good action scenes, but they failed. No, it's all there. Anything that movie wanted to do, it did well.
Mm-hmm.
If that movie did not do characterization well, it's because it didn't want to. And why did it not want to? Who the fuck needs it in this goddamn movie? It's Speed Racer!
I guess then the argument becomes that if the movie didn't aspire to be anything beyond maybe a very fun homage to an anime that never really valued characterization in the first place, then you could make the argument then, was this really a movie then that should have been made at the cinematic level? I mean, if this is all Speed Racer is, and if this is all that Speed Racer really ever aspires to be, then is the cinematic format then the perfect place for it? Why not devote all this money and energy into, say, a new version of the cartoon or something that, you know, flaws that the movie had would be more easily accepted in a different format?
Well, I mean, honestly, in that case, you're not assaulting the movie itself. You're assaulting the reasoning behind it at the executive level. Mm-hmm. And that's something I really can't answer to, honestly, because that's not something that you can fairly put on the movie itself and how it was done or how it was made.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, if I had to venture a guess on it, I would simply say, you know, they had the idea, hey, you know, what? This anime had a lot of cool ideas with it, had a lot of cool imagery to it, but they really didn't do it very well back then because budget constraints and you know, technology restraints. What if we took those same ideas? What if we took what the original wanted to be and made that? And they did. And you know, it wouldn't be the first time that this has been done, and it certainly was not the last that it was done. And I would say that this movie stands out a lot. I mean, goddamn, remember the Dukes of Hazzard movie?
Vaguely.
Exactly. And
Burt Reynolds was in it, right?
Was he? Yeah, he was.
He was Bob Hogg. Yeah,
and Willie Nelson as Uncle Jesse. That movie was, it was okay, but what it was trying to be, what it should have been, it really wasn't. It felt like a redone TV show compressed into movie form. This actually felt like it was a cinematic movie. The shit that was done in this movie could not have been done in any other format. You couldn't have done this on a TV show. At least not in 2008 when this was made. You might could now, but you'd have a way higher budget for it than what Speed Racer would deserve for a TV show. And, you know, maybe the idea was for this to reboot a series or something. I know the Wachowski brothers directed it, the same guys that did, you know, The Matrix and V for Vendetta. Maybe this was a project of love for them. And if it was, it shows to me. You can tell by watching this that they cared about the source material.
Mm-hmm.
They had something in mind that they wanted to do with it. And I don't think it was – it doesn't feel like something to me that was done just because a studio exec said, you know, make me a Speed Racer movie or I'll eat out your eyeballs. His fucking, you know, coke dust falls off of his nose. This felt like something that they wanted to do. This felt like something that they had maybe a personal reason to do. It very well may have been, you know, kind of a labor of love. And if that's the case, then it showed. If it wasn't, well, they did a good job of faking it. It was a fun movie. It's not something you're going to watch for deep entertainment. It's not meant to be. It's a great way to, you know, kill an evening if you're having a few beers and just want to see something cool, or if you're a kid. It's very much a kid's movie, keep in mind. I mean, the as we've said earlier, pandering to the young audience is very evident here.
Those flashback scenes, good God.
It does have some of that, but it's very much a kid's movie at heart. With, you know, enough action there in the racing and everything to kind of keep an adult from, reviling the time spent with it. I thought it was fun personally, but again, I might be more immature than most adults. Shut the fuck up. Don't even, you say a word. Don't say a goddamn word, Mike.
I guess, though, the biggest thing, all these flaws that I've mentioned, and I think this is the biggest fault of the movie, is that a legitimately bad movie that you can at least appreciate, like one of the films that you've defended previously, Battlefield Earth,
mm-hmm.
That is a movie that is so bad that after you watch it, you're never going to forget Battlefield Earth. For better or worse, you will not forget that movie. But when it comes to Speed Racer, and this is the biggest flaw I think any movie can have, this is the biggest strike you can have against a movie, whether it's good or bad, is that it's just sort of forgettable. It kind of has a bit of what you touched on earlier, the Star Trek insurrection syndrome. Because there's so much CGI going on and your brain just kind of stops processing it at a certain point, and because the characters are all so one-dimensional, you really don't have – you're really not inclined to care about them or remember them. Once it's over, you kind of go, well, yeah, I saw a Speed Racer movie, but, you know, it was just like a Speed Racer movie. Like, so many of the plot points, so many of the character moments, they just don't register because they're either so weak or they're drowned out by a barrage of CGI visuals.
Okay, here's my... First off, I'll say that I'm the bad movie public defender, not the forgettable or mediocre movie public defender. So if it reaches that status, then my job is done. Though I'll go beyond that and simply say I disagree, because for me the visual style, like I said, when this was first brought to me by one of our listeners, a request for me to defend this movie, my first thought was, oh yeah, I remember that. That was the one. And in my mind, I'm remembering that visual style and the races and everything like that. And that was some years ago that I'd seen it. So, I mean, it's not forgettable in that particular sense. And I, in terms of what it was about, well, it's Speed Racer and he's doing Speed Racer things. It's not like Star Trek Insurrection where it was trying to be a gripping sci-fi action drama thing and, you know, wrestle with these heavy themes that Star Trek wrestles with. And by God, were they trying in that movie? You know,
they certainly tried.
Yeah, exactly. Star Trek Insurrection was a movie that tried to do something and it failed at it. Speed Racer is a movie that tried to do something and succeeded wonderfully at it. Now, whether or not you like what it was trying to do, that's on you. But the movie did what it did, and it did it damn good.
I'll tell you what I remember from Speed Racer, and this is interesting because the things that I remember that when people say, oh, it's a Speed Racer movie, these are the things that come to mind. And I don't know and I'm still undecided if I think that speaks to the movie's strengths or weaknesses, but when you bring Speed Racer up to me, the first thing I remember is that scene where Royalton is showing Speed Racer that broken hunk of car engine.
As a transmission, but yes.
Yeah, transmission. But he he's kind of telling the story of like this great weight racer way back when who got into this like huge accident. But the footage they're using is of like really old like racing, right? Like it's like really old school cars in that flashback, correct?
Right. Yeah.
And in my mind, I'm thinking this world is so stylized. The cars in this world are so out there. But for this flashback, they're using really old school racing footage. So in my mind, me always wanting to fill in backstory, that's sort of just a problem I have when it comes to movies. I was like, what happened? What huge technology led from that world to the world of this movie? Yes?
Actually, now in terms of technology and how they got from that point to cars fucking doing aerial stunts and all this other shit, you know, I couldn't tell you. I think that comes down to shut the fuck up and watch the movie they give you.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this. I know the scene that you're talking about, when I seen that, my first thought was, you know, they actually went back through the racing footage and found cars stylistically, like in terms of like body styling, that their logical progression of evolution would be the cars that we're showing is modern. You know, if you looked at like the body styles and shapes of those cars, they actually, you could see like design cues and things like that to retro styling and retro cars in their modern counterparts. And I thought that was kind of cool that they didn't show fucking footage from the 1970s. They went back to, you know, the late 40s and shit like that. That's what, you know, you look at the Mach 5 and it's got that kind of retro vibe to it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the other cars have that same thing going on. I think they found cars that would fit in with that in terms of, you know, what leaps and bounds in technology and the timeline and everything. You know, I actually found myself wondering that too, to a degree. I would not call that a failing of the movie, however. I would actually say that that's a success of the movie. If the movie can make you care enough to want to know more about the backstory, then you know what? They did a pretty damn good job.
I'm not finished my point. And the second thing that I remember that comes to mind when people say the Speed Racer movie is the very beginning, actually, where they have the race car. They have the race announcer, the announcer for the race, and the commentator, and he's providing the backstory, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's actually a really good way to get a lot of backstory to the audience without bogging it down of exposition. Because it's natural to believe that a commentator would comment on something like that over the course of a race. So I thought that that was a great way to sort of get the exposition out without bogging the film down. Now what I've said are two things that, you know, at first glance, you might say, Mike, well, it seems like you liked those two aspects of the movie. And yes, I did. But my point on why I can't really decide if these two instances are to the movie's detriment or not is because at the end of the day, Those above any other scene are the two that come to mind when I when the Speed Racer movie is mentioned. And if the two scenes that come to mind for me are a scene that showed old race car footage and my main interest was backstory, and the second was an exposition dump at the beginning of the movie, then I kind of have to think, well, how memorable was that movie really if those are the two standout scenes to me? Like, if the rest of the movie just sort of faded into the abyss and those are the only two parts that stand out, what does that say about it?
Well, I'll be honest with you. The only thing that I can think of, and I know, you know, recalling the scene that you're discussing here, I think maybe, and this is just me venturing a guess once again, you know, maybe the reason why they didn't use that more later on in the movie is that is kind of an overused mechanism in any kind of movie that's remotely, quote-unquote, sport-related. Mm-hmm. Maybe they did not want to over-rely on it.
Now, well, I think See, remember the movie? Oh, fuck, I can't remember. Rollerball, that, the new one. That, well, relatively new. Came out around 2000, 2001-ish.
Never seen it.
Well, the reason why I bring it up is because the guy, it's this kind of death sport called Rollerball. I can't say that word. But the commentator for all the matches was played by a gentleman named Paul Heyman, who wrestling fans will know as the former owner slash manager of ECW and currently a manager in the WWE whose client, Brock Lesnar, defeated The Undertaker's streak. Point being, the most awesome part about that movie was Paul Heyman playing the commentator. Like, you go back and watch it, you're like, you know what, Paul? You fucking earned your paycheck for this one. Because he went all out. He owned that commentary role. And the filmmakers realized that and kind of used him as sort of a linchpin to build these rollerball matches around. So I don't necessarily, like, I think that if you have a good actor on doing the commentary role in your sports-themed movie, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing to overemphasize him. Bob Uecker, for example, in the movie Major League, you know, people love him because he was the commentator for the Cleveland Indians in that movie, and people loved his role there. So it's one of those things where if you've got someone who does a good job in the role, it's not really a detriment to overuse them.
It's not. But I don't think that would have really, I don't know, I really don't think that would have been, I don't know, I'm not saying the movie would not have maybe, I'm not saying it would have been out of place in the movie, but I don't think they really cared. I don't think that was what they were, that was not where they were trying to put their emphasis on.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to basically put the emphasis on the action. And when the action wasn't going on, you know, it was, well, what's going on, quote unquote, plot wise that will give us enough context to understand why the coming action is important. And a commentator serving in that capacity would have served neither of those roles. It would have not have A, added to the action, or B, done a whole lot to explain personally why to the characters why the action that we were seeing was important.
Mm.
This was a movie that was very focused. It was focused, you know, even though there admittedly was not much characterization because there doesn't need to be, it was still focused on the characters and why they were doing what they were doing, however simplistic their reasoning may be.
Mm-hmm.
And a commentator announcing and giving exposition would have not have served that, and in fact it would have taken away a little bit from that explanation, from the motivation of the people involved. You had, you know, Plothro, who was trying to, you know, take over all of the businesses. And you had Speed Racer, who's like, the little guy can still matter, and I'll show you why.
And then you had Asians. Like,
yes.
There's like those Asian characters who I honestly can't remember what they did. I just remember they, like, stood in, like, they stood in some scenes, and they looked menacing.
They were kind of your, like a, they're your kind of like Chinese mafia or
that's what they were doing.
That was basically kind of their shtick, I think. Or they, well, not even that. They were a competing car manufacturer. They just kind of had a bit of a nefarious vibe to them, except for the one chick.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I don't see where that would have really, you know, what you're suggesting with the commentator. I don't see where that would have really helped the movie any. I don't think that would have had too much of a place in it, really. I mean, and again, I'll just kind of circle back around and say, you know, the fact that, you know, it made us think about the backstory and a little bit of the history in this fictional universe. I mean, I think that does the movie some credit that it made you care.
Fair enough. And with that, the bad movie Public Defender's case against Speed Racer rests. And it's up to you listeners to decide whether or not Jack rescued this film from the abyss of terribleness.
That being said, now we're episode 21 now.
Mm-hmm.
Our 26th episode will be our 6-month anniversary episode.
Woo!
There has been an idea, of course, you and I have been kicking around for the bad movie Public Defender.
Okay.
I think we'll go ahead and let the cat out of the bag. What do you say?
Go ahead.
For the 6-month anniversary episode, episode number 26, I will be defending perhaps one of the most reviled and hated movies in history, Highlander 2.
Woo.
Send your death threats to basically ageekshow@gmail.com so that I can laugh at them.
Highlander 2, that one's going to be tough, man. I don't even think I need to prepare for that one. I'm just going to have a bowl of pistachios, and I'm going to sit back. I'm going to enjoy myself as you flounder to defend that horrible piece of cinematic garbage. But we'll save the particulars for 5 weeks from now. Point being, episode 21 is now come to a close. As Jack pointed out, you can send us an email at basically ageekshow@gmail.com. You can catch us on Twitter at ageekshow. Other than that, you can catch us on Spreaker, Stitcher, iTunes, and of course you can catch us on YouTube and basicallyasportsshow.com. For Jack, this is Mike signing off episode 21.
Good night, everybody.
Try again.